How's everybody doing? Welcome back to Classical Guitar Insider. This is your host, Brett Williams. Today on the show, we've got Rez Abbasi. He is, I haven't listened or edited the interview yet, but I think he's a New York guy, if I remember correctly. I did this way back at the Elnora Guitar Festival, and they're sponsoring the show. Elnora Guitar Festival, Kranitz Center for the Performing Arts, University of Illinois. So, yeah, he came on and we had a wonderful conversation about jazz. I think he went to the Manhattan School of Music as well. So it's a great tie-in. And the show is sponsored by Simon Powis and ClassicalGuitarCorner.com. You can go there and you get lessons from Simon, who's a great guy. And you can go and get a guitar at SavageClassical.com. That's Savage, S-A-V-A-G-E, Classical.com. Richard Sage will get you the guitar of your dream. Then head on over to ClassicalGuitarCorner.com and get a lesson from the immortal and very beautiful Simon Powis. So it's today is a Friday. What is it? Friday the 13th. Friday, April 13th. Is this like a bad luck day or a good luck day? I think it's a bad day. Every day is a bad day for me. Thanks to Facebook. Jesus, I fucking hate Facebook. The only reason I keep it on there is so that you guys can contact me. Or whatever, not really contact me. If you're going to contact me, I had a bunch of wonderful questions that came in, actually two questions, and they both came in over Facebook. If you want to talk, I love talking to you guys. I will always get back to you. It's just go ahead and email me at brett@brettwilliamsmusic.com. You can go there too. Oh, okay, let's just see here. Let me turn this off. Sorry, I forgot to turn the Wi-Fi off. We're getting dings. All right, so what was I saying? What the hell was I talking about? Oh, yeah, contact me. You can contact me through that. The Facebook thing's fine. It's just it buzzes like a text, and then I'm getting a text from somebody who I've never met, which is fine, you know. It's just, you know, I'd rather kind of keep these things there. No problem with anybody who contacted me or is going to contact me over Facebook. That's fine. I've deleted the app from my phone. I can't stand it. It, like, ruined my entire week. You know, it's just, oh, geez, you know. Really. But yeah, I don't know. It has something to do with the breakup and everything. This breakup is just fucking killing me. It's just not getting better. So yeah, speaking of that in taxes, a little tie-in here. My guy is hilarious. I've had the same guys, the Jürgen guys. I'm going to give them a free plug. That's Eric and Marguerite Jürgen. They're my tax people. They have been for 13 years or 12 years or whatever. And, they know everything about me. They know that I'm broke. They know that I've been in, a couple of breakups now, and they know that I'm 41 and alone and that I have a roommate. So it's just funny because he says, yeah, I heard you guys broke up. And I go, oh yeah. And he goes, yeah, I see you guys have a different address now. And I was like, yeah, you're right. And he's like, ah, well, you know, as they say, plenty of fish in the sea. And they're the best and they're inexpensive. Anyway. Yeah. So this has been fucking killing me. Anyway. So let's go ahead. I am going to log into Facebook here real quick because I do want to read some of these listener questions. Let's just see if it helps me out. No, I'm not connected to the internet now. See what I do for you guys? Now we're going to wait for that to start back up. There we go. Let's try it again. And just a couple of things and we're in. So let's go ahead to Messenger. You know what? I actually got to go. One second. I'll come back to this. I got a student coming in 4 minutes. I'll read his question and then I'll come back to it. No, I better get ready. All right. I'll get back to this in a second. I'm just going to teach this student in my apartment and I'll get back to you guys. All right, everybody. So that was a no-show student. Have you ever had one of those? it's the in-home lessons, you know? I mean, that's the thing. I don't know. I charged her half. I told her I'd charge her full time. These are adult students. Kind of adult students. I mean, she's a young green pointer. And, you know, I want to keep things nice because it is like that would have been our second lesson. But yeah, they do that sometimes, the adults. It's the kids do it too. What am I talking about? Anyway, so that happened 15 minutes ago, and now we're back on. What was I talking about? Let's go ahead and read, what's his name? Let me turn all the phones and everything off there. You know, that's on vibrate. Okay, let's go ahead and read Nick's thing like I was doing. Where is this messenger? There it is. All right, here it goes. Quick question for you. If you have a few minutes, this is again from Nick Buffalino. I'm wondering what approach, you know, I think I read that part. Did I read the part? Did I read the beginning? I don't remember. But we're just going to start over. Quick question for you, if you have a few minutes. I'm wondering what your approach is to composing for the guitar. Do the ideas blossom out of random improvisation sessions, which are then doctored to be musically correct, or do you have some other approach? Sitting down with an empty guitar pro project or paper, perhaps, etc. I personally played as a self-taught metal guitarist for about a decade before becoming rabid for classical guitar. Going through music school was quite a trip, kind of like putting labels on thousands of blank files in a filing cabinet. I suppose it was out of ignorance, but I never really learned chords or notes prior to school, but was able to progress nicely by way of feeling things out. That's interesting. No chords. All right. There's something odd that happens when you isolate yourself for several years and develop your own language before entering into an intensive classical training routine. For this reason, I want to apply the knowledge I acquire in school for composing, but most of the time I resort to this weird internal language when developing my pieces. I'm wondering if you've talked to many musicians who have spent a considerable amount of time learning guitar in a non-standardized way, who have then gone on to be proficient in classical music. Thanks for letting me pick your brain a bit. Take care, and maybe see you at the Long Island Guitar Festival this week. Hey, I'm not trying to do a plug for the Long Island Guitar Festival, but I know I played there once, long time ago. What's his name? Horace Becker? Is that his name? Something Becker. Tell him that Brett says hi of La Vida Williams Guitar Duo. And I'm glad he put me on. Anyway, so the Long Island Guitar Festival just got a plug, as well as my tax person for reminding me of the fact that I'm sad. But yeah, let's talk about that. So, you know, first off, Nick, I think it's interesting that people, you know, I'm looking at your picture. You look like you're maybe about my age. And it's sort of interesting what we can bring to the table, because I was the same. I think most people who were born in the 70s or early 80s tend to be that way, tend to come to American-wise. We tend to come to the classical guitar after rocking out for a couple of years or being in jazz or whatever. And we can bring a lot to the table, or we can really fuck things up. And I've seen both things happen. I consider myself to be someone that got to a level of technical proficiency that is competitive, and I, you know, I think that if, as long as I have that, and as long as we have that as people that approach the guitar from that direction, we can actually infuse a lot of things that I see people who have been playing classical guitar their entire life and maybe haven't done so much of the other styles, they lack a little bit. You know what I mean? There's a certain sensitivity or a certain aggressiveness that you can bring to things as a metal player, particularly as a composer, that a classical guitarist seems to, I don't know, maybe struggle with. I don't know. We have a point of view. Everybody has a perspective. And as long as you put the time in and the years in and the decades in to becoming technically proficient on the guitar, it's a good thing. Because back when we were going to school, you know, they would kind of churn out students whether they were prepared to be competitive or not. And that has created a lot of colleges with bad teachers. It's created a lot of problems. And it's led to a culture of disrespect towards our instrument within the community of classical musicians. And we don't want that, but at the same time, you know, I feel like that the perspective of having a different upbringing with the guitar is always welcome, should be. As far as my compositions are concerned, I talked to Carlos Rivera. I even brought it up a couple of episodes ago about how I was struggling with writing a fast piece and what to do when you're writing a quick piece and how it can end so quickly and you've developed the theme to exhaustion within 30 seconds and it's time to move on. What do you do? And he said, just keep writing. And that's really what it comes down to, is just keep writing and then keep refining. You know, as far as the form is concerned, he had said that he doesn't really focus too much on that until he's kind of nearing the end of the piece. So 75% or 85% of the way in, he's looking back and he's going, okay, there's some balance issues here. And I found that that's what I was kind of doing anyway. And thank you, Carlos Rivera, one of the best composers in the world, for getting back to me on that unsolicited. I didn't even have to ask. He just listened to the episode and wrote in. So this is what it comes down to, is you're going to be as good a composer as you can be. That's going to be your influences, everything that you are aesthetically, everything that you let in, you know, and everything that you appreciate just about the relationship between two notes. You know, with me, when I'm listening to music, I'm a suspension junkie. You know, it's a note that is held from one chord and suspended over another chord. So it can sound dissonant, or it's certainly, it at a minimum, it's a non-chord tone. And the idea is that it's eventually supposed to resolve, but I don't know. Now I'm getting off track. I just love suspensions. I love the idea of this. I'm going to talk about suspensions for 2 seconds. It's my favorite thing. I try not to employ it too much into what I do because it is my favorite thing, and I don't want to fall into the trap of being a suspension lover boy. But a piece like Mahler's Fifth Symphony, Second Movement, one of my favorites. You know, it's that's just littered with suspensions. And what I love about it is actually got like a, you can actually sort of quantify it in poetic terms. You know, the suspension is beautiful because it needs to be resolved. But once it's resolved, it's no longer a suspension. It's no longer there. But it does create a dissonance, and it creates in the listener a need to hear it go somewhere. But in that need is the beauty. So it's completely romantic on every level. You know, the sense, the infinite longing that it creates. If you've left the suspension there, it's not doing what you maybe want it to do, but it's creating this wonderful, you know, sort of anxiety in you. And that's as romantic as it gets. I at least some point in my education, I heard the romantic movement in literature, painting, and music described as infinite longing. And I don't think that's a dictionary definition, but that's always been mine. So, you know, I always kind of focus on those small relationships when I'm creating some sort of a theme. Or, yeah, there certainly is a degree of noodling, especially with the faster pieces. With the faster pieces, I tend to kind of noodle around to find something that works physically on the guitar well, that I know I'm going to be able to play in sequence. And what I mean by that is a sequence is basically when you take one group of notes and you take a rhythm, right? And you move it through different groups of notes. So it's like da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da. Like that is taking a rhythmic idea and bringing it through sequentially through the piece. So when I'm creating something like that, I am at the guitar. A lot of times I try to get off the guitar, particularly for the slow pieces when I'm forming melody. And I'm just trying to think about, I'm free flow. I don't intentionally employ anything into the music. That's it. Just keep writing. Make sure that your influences are there. Make sure you know what you like about your influences. And I think that's what's important about the suspension thing that I brought up, is that's something that I like. Why do I like it? And I think I told you why, you know, and just sort of understanding that, internalizing it, and then almost putting it into your work subconsciously, or at least putting your respect for that musical idea into your work subconsciously. Anyway, that's the deal. Let's go on. We've already talked for 15 minutes. It's been a long intro. I'm sorry. There was a lot going on. But Nick, thanks for writing in. And let's get on with the show. Here is Rez Abbasi. you know, we just were talking about how you moved to L.A. from Pakistan when you were four. What part of L.A. do you live in?
Redondo Beach, Torrance, that whole...
I was a Manhattan Beach kid.
Oh, yeah? Okay, yeah.
Are
yeah,
you, like, are you about... You're about the same age, probably, and...
51, yeah.
You're 50, okay, so 51. I'm 40.
Not quite.
I was
quite
in Manhattan Beach for a couple of years. My parents couldn't afford it. We moved to the beautiful city, the municipality of Stockton, where we rotted for a while, and then, you know, rose like a phoenix.
Oh, that's nice. So it was good to rise.
Like it was always good to rise. But you're Redondo.
That whole area, you know, Torrance, Redondo. I grew up surfing and all kinds of stuff. You know, all the benefits of growing up in Southern California. I took advantage of them all, basically.
So many benefits. Yeah, it's so you did surf.
Yeah, sir. Yeah, and then many other things. Yeah. Motocross, you know, surfing. I did all this, all these very skiing. Obviously, you know, all these sports. You know, and it's. It's, you know, then when I got serious about music, obviously I had to curtail that whole end of my life.
Well, you can probably do a little bit of the surfing, a little bit, but once you see the waves get anything
feet,
you're like,
tell me
about
it. Stop. Yeah.
I did the same thing. I was kind of a skier a little bit growing up. I'd come home from college, and I think one time, like, I just fell, and I was like, what if I fell on my hand?
Exactly.
No junior recital.
Yeah.
Well, so it's
let fun. Alone a senior recital.
And going, and then you start. Yeah, you started going into. You started. It seems like you studied some classical. You went to Manhattan School of Music.
Yeah, and USC actually before that.
And who did you study with at USC?
Well, USC there was a teacher named Paula Rose who passed away.
Right.
From Lou Gehrig's actually disease, unfortunately, and he was an amazing teacher. And he was a very thorough teacher, which is hard to find these days, you know.
Yeah.
He wasn't a specialist. He was like this overall, you know, teacher, and it was fantastic.
He played jazz. He played everything.
He was involved with everything. I don't know how much like classical guitar he played and all that, but he was involved with it.
He's a teacher too.
Yeah. And that's a great player too. And he went to school with Pat Metheny and Jaco Pastorius for a while in Miami. So he had these good people around him, and he had his aesthetic was really high, and it was just bountiful lessons to have with him every time, you know.
Yeah.
So he was one teacher, and then Joe Dioria was another teacher who's out in Connecticut now. Yeah, he's another amazing teacher.
Where is he at the Hartford or something?
No, he's not. I don't think he's teaching at college, but he was another teacher there. And then Scott Tennant was my classical guitar teacher. Who just performed with the LA.
Oh, yeah, they were just in here.
I just saw him perform now. So,
and I didn't see the Pat Metheny piece because I came in here to talk to... he just told me how to say his name, but it's spelt like Guido, but it's Guido.
Oh, Guido, okay.
Yeah, he's a new teacher here. But we both had to leave because we had to start this thing. So Scott Tennant gave you some of the classical chops.
Yeah, and it was just
which
a well balanced.
You clearly had.
Yeah, it was a very well balanced sort of a couple years I had at USC.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then after that, I decided to transfer to New York because people were telling me that my sound was very New York like. Whatever that means, you know.
What do you think that does mean? Because I understand the West Coast, East Coast thing to a degree, but I mean that sort of New Age jazz thing really doesn't exist.
No, I know what you mean.
Popular form. So right now we're kind of back to the standards or the avant-garde.
Yeah. I think
smooth jazz is out.
It seems that way. Yeah. I mean, it's always there, but but, you know, I think, I had a conversation about this a while ago. I think it's a rawness and a looseness that's sort of the New York sound.
Yeah.
You know.
It's not perfect.
But the strange thing is there's a lot of people who aren't like that either in New York. But you do have them. Yeah. Whereas in L.A., they're not too many people who are very loose about the music and really edgy on, you know, and raw.
They form an idea. And they execute the idea.
It seems that way.
To the best of their ability.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to categorize people.
No,
like
we don't. We don't. But definitely, you know, I think people sort of think like, it's sexy, like Stan Getz. And I'm like, well, yeah, back then. But also, if you look at Stan Getz, like that's pretty smooth and clean playing.
Yeah.
You know, what I mean?
I mean, he had his other side too. But
he's a New York guy too.
Yeah, he was sort of noted as that, you know.
Yeah.
The boss. I mean, everybody seems to know him for the bossa novas and stuff, but he's
actually
an amazing, totally, yeah, incredible jazz straight ahead, I guess, for lack of a better
straight ahead term, yeah.
Player, you know.
Yeah. What would you consider yourself? I mean, because I saw you play with the in the showcase at the end of the night on the opening.
Right.
I have not seen you since.
Yeah.
Did you play today? Or
we just did my live film score. It was a live group quintet to a black and white silent film, which lasts an hour and 14 minutes.
Where'd you do that? Just here?
Throw of Dice. Yeah, we just did that. Yeah, and that was our second run of this. Not here, but this we did our first run in our debut in Manhattan.
So. Well, tell me about that. That is these projects are happening a lot of multimedia.
Yeah, I guess you can call it that. Yeah, I mean it is multimedia.
It's an art piece. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's just. It was really an amazing experience for me to compose music to something that was sort of already finished, you know. And you know, in that sense, it I quickly realized it was really beyond. It was beyond just what I want to write in the music, but I had to really address the characters, and
yeah.
You know, it wasn't just about me. Like all my records are basically anything I want to do, I will do. You know, in this case, it's a film. It's, you know, predetermined.
Randy calls it writing to assignment.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
and how
yeah.
he enjoys that.
Well, yeah, but the only difference I think between that and this is this is supposed to gravitate towards the artistic side of it. Also, it's not. There's no director because it was a 1929 film, and it's silent. So there's no predisposition or any idea other than the directives that came from the film,
right?
And those directives are multi-dimensional emotional output. You know, the characters are so complex, and you know, for instance, like you know, if there was a sad scene, it's the gradation of sadness is so different in the many sad scenes there might be.
Right.
So I have to write towards that gradation, not just a sad piece.
Right.
So that becomes onto itself, a task. You know, like a complex.
Yeah.
You know. So you know, in that sense.
Well, when you're doing something like that, it's like I would imagine that you have to play against what the film is doing to create a cohesive. Sometimes, if something sad is happening and the music is really, really sad, it becomes mono, just a mono thing coming at you.
Yeah,
it doesn't have the same sort of effect.
You need a little bit of a counter effect.
We're cooking here. We got to get a little bit of sweet. We got a little bit of salty.
Yeah,
and the thing is, if you don't do that, if you're really not balancing the flavors, you're not really cooking. You're just sort of throwing a piece of chicken at someone's face.
Yes, exactly. But, you know, the strange thing is... you know, the difference between this and a contemporary, you know, film score, if you will.
Sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh. Yeah, sorry about that. It's just like I keep on forgetting to tell people that. And it's like, because I don't have the things with this, my kind of, what you call it, rig?
On the road.
I take on the road rig. So it's like I get these, and these pick up everything. They're little conduits of noise.
Yeah. Of course.
Anyway, go ahead.
So I was saying, the difference between this and a contemporary film score, if I were to, get employed for something like that is that, you know, there's no, like I said, there's no director telling me how to do anything. Yeah. So it's really, and it's also incumbent on me and sort of a self-imposed mandate that I made it reflect my own, music and my own vision.
Yeah.
So it can stand alone as a music piece. And applied to the film, it opens up even more because you have now this visual aspect of it. So it was a very artistic project, and that's the beauty of it.
Yeah, that's really, I mean, it's beautiful. So, I mean, the thing is that when we have an opportunity to, as musicians, become more than ourselves, especially as guitarists, because we really
good
have
way
that
to say it,
isolated... We live in an isolated world of practice, a lot of solo concerts, things like that.
Yeah,
so when you get these opportunities, they're just, I mean, they're so overwhelmingly filled with joy for me.
Yeah, yeah. It's
whenever
it's,
you get the opportunity to play with just anything else. It happens when you're young and you're going to college. And
you're right.
You feel like people are making you do it. I remember feeling like that. Yeah. I don't want to play a Ebert flute piece.
Let me just work on my solo stuff. But now it's sort of like, you've had enough
time alone.
You know, you've had plenty of hours in the shed doing your thing. It's like, this is getting a little boring here. You want to play, you know, anything? Yeah, let's do it. You know, the collective idea is something that I always yearned for all the time, ever since I was a kid. You know,
but when you were a kid, I mean, that's the thing, is you started obviously you studied some classical, a lot of classical. When you were a kid, what did you start out playing? Did you start playing blues? Did you start playing classical?
The basic piano lessons that every kid has. I discovered the guitar at 11 and through my brother and uncle who brought home a guitar. And then I started playing Led Zeppelin, and I think that was one of the first songs.
Yeah.
You know?
The
typical things. And then I got in a garage band and played all of Rush records and you know, these kinds of little bit more interesting.
Who the drummer in your garage band was like, we got to play Rush? That was my drummer.
Yeah,
he's like, I'll do it if we could play.
Yeah, basically. And he did. He pulled it off. Mark Ornberger.
Sorry, Ty Ive. Ty Ive, buddy, you did not pull off the Rush.
Well, this guy did.
We played Cure instead.
Oh, hey. Well, I love the Cure, yeah.
Yeah, I did too, no,
but remember Spirit of the Radio and all those little drum fills, you know. Yeah. So Tom Sawyer, all that. So, yeah, it's all good stuff. But then, you know,
that's a musical education.
Isn't it? Yeah, it really is. And you know what? It still provides an education. I still listen to that stuff with a different filter and see it in a different light rather than, you know, party music or something. Or a garage band music. I'll see it as composition now, and that just opens up all kinds of parameters in my brain, just to, like, you know, see what they're doing with certain elements of music that I can, you know, use in my own. So, but then, you know, the jazz bug hit me when I was 16. So there it was. You know, I dropped all that other music and went straight to.
Straight ahead jazz?
I mean, you know, that's where you start jazz. I mean, you know, it.
Who was your guys back then? Who were you? Who were your, like, the first?
Well,
even if it was just Vince Guaraldi.
Yeah, no. It probably was subconsciously just watching all that. But
yeah.
I went to the thing. One of my friends took me to see Ella Fitzgerald, and Joe Pass was on guitar. So that was sort of an enlightening moment. I was like, oh my god, this guy is playing circles around, you know, Van Halen and all these other people that at that very moment I was just transitioning out of. And
you were worshiping them at one point.
And so Joe Pass was one. And then it's ironically sort of on the other, complete other side of the spectrum of jazz, if you will. Very soon after, I saw Alan Holdsworth, my friend said took me to, you know. And so there I was with Joe Pass and Alan Holdsworth and, you know, what totally different, you know, players within this field, I guess, of jazz, because it's a ever widening field. And and then of course Benson and Wes Montgomery and, you know, the gamut. I mean, Pat Martino, the whole gamut of players, and then of course Bill Frisell, Matheny, Schofield, Abercrombie, you know. So it just happens like that. I mean, it seems.
Right.
And then obviously non-guitar players. That's where I sort of switched to non-guitar players years ago, decades ago. You know, I mean, literally like 25, 30 years ago. I was much more into saxophone. I was still a young puppy back then, but much more into saxophone and piano. And I just heard them liberate the music in a way that, you know, was very different from guitar.
Yeah. Know. Well, just have to forget the people outside. It's just the way it goes.
Oh, no, I don't care.
I don't know. I don't think they always see what's happening.
No, it doesn't matter.
They're done talking. Anyway, so, yeah, as far as, I mean, that. So going into the saxophone then, who were you guys for that? Who's your saxophone guy? Just Coltrane?
You know, yeah, I mean, I know that's exactly.
I didn't get him until recently.
Well, that's okay. Yeah. You can admit that.
I wanted to be a Miles guy, and I think I was.
Well,
but
you can be both.
Yeah, you can be both. But I think I recently heard just, what is it? The Trained, the first Coltrane album, the one with his face on the cover. What's the name of that album?
You're talking about Giant Steps came out before Blue Train.
Maybe it was Blue Train.
Well, Blue Train is
what's one. What's the one with
da, 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 da. Yeah, Naima.
Yeah, that's on Blue Train, right?
I think no, that's on Giant Steps.
It's on Giant Steps.
Yeah. Yeah, that was my seminal record also.
Yeah, just recently listening to that song, I was just like,
yeah,
where he chooses to place it,
of course,
is just you're never going to hear. I haven't heard anybody more on top of the beat and more exactly placing it where he wants.
You're right about that. Actually,
than John Coltrane.
Yeah,
and I didn't really
mention that.
When you're a kid, you're more like interested in like the harmonic and. And I'm a classical guy, so I'm listening to Wagner, and I'm like into the harmonic implications of what's being presented, or the tonal implications, or the instrumentation.
Yeah.
But once you get down to like when someone is doing something, there's nothing better than that guy.
It's I mean, especially when they're improvising and their time is exceptionally solid like that. I mean,
yeah.
You know, he can stretch his time also, but you know, you hear him on the ballads, and he's much more elastic in a sense, but. On these kind of, well, like on Naima, on more up-tempo tunes like Giant Steps and stuff, and the many tunes he wrote after that, it's like this perfect straight eighth kind of note-to-note kind of rhythm.
I think one of my first records that I bought of his when I was a kid was the one with him and Duke Ellington.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
I think that one, I don't know, I don't think that's such a great album. I don't know.
It's a good
album because I love Duke Ellington, but I feel like I was kind of thrown off because Duke... is loose, you know,
yeah,
or he's well, super. I mean
I love
when
that,
he plays
I love
piano,
the album,
he's super
but,
loose, you know.
But yeah, I mean, you know, I
you love that album. I mean, that's the album, yeah.
Yeah, well, there's so many, but I like
I'm looseness. Talking about jazz. First, I don't know shit about jazz. I mean, I know I know that Coltrane, as a musician, recently had an effect on
me. Well, that's why I appreciate you doing this interview because, you know, it's like it's you're thinking outside the box for yourself.
Oh, dude, that's all it's
good.
About.
Yeah.
It's all about me.
Right. You learn something
about
yourself every day.
Yeah, well, these are musicians. They need to learn this stuff.
We need
to be talking about it. We all should be talking to each other. And that's what the festival's about. I keep on reiterating that point. I hope you guys don't get tired of it. But the thing is that we're all here to celebrate the instrument. We're not here to celebrate a genre or a style or a country.
Or just one kind of player.
We have all sorts of players. We've even got two different kinds of, you know, I was like looking at the way that that Reinhard and Daniel played, and then, you know, looking at the difference between that and the way that
Kevin,
Chris and Julian are playing.
Oh, okay.
Did you see them?
No, I didn't.
Oh, man. You just got to check them out. It's so tight. Get that whole Nashville tightness.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, so going back to it, though, yeah. So as far as, like, doing things at the right time, Coltrane was one of those people you went to. What do you think about, like, jazz phrasing? I mean, we're getting a little more musical than we usually get here, believe it or not. But as far as like
sometimes jazz will do that to you.
Yeah, sometimes talking about it, I'm starting to get into talking about it all of a sudden. But like as far as like what's your approach? Like, what do you do? Do you connect with when you're phrasing? When you're deciding where to place notes? I saw you play. You're unbelievable. You're phenomenal. You're fast. You got all the skills. There's no doubt about that. But your phrasing's also there. Like, what are you doing? Do you have a process to it? Do you? Do you have a lot of licks, or are
no,
you?
Absolutely
no,
not,
you don't
no.
seem like a lick guy. You seem
no,
more like
I'm,
a go.
I'm definitely
go
not.
Get
I can't. I can't do that. You know.
Yeah.
You know. It's funny because I don't even know how. You know, I always wanted to be a comedian at one point in my life, but then you know, now I just see them and watch them, and I don't know how they go up there and say the same things over and over again. Like I'm just putting
either.
It through my filter and thinking to myself, God, you know, I don't think I would be able to do that every day.
Yeah.
Or a theater, you know, person.
Or a classical guitar.
Oh, well, there you go. I mean, that's the
obvious comparison.
Reflection of what we're talking about. But still, with all those kinds of, all those types of people who do that on a daily basis and sort of repeat themselves, there's a muscle they need to build up that's different than something I've built up. I would have to build up that muscle if I had to do that every night. And I don't have that muscle. It's sort of like I need to be spontaneous, and that's just something that's really in me. And obviously that's why I chose jazz. But even within the jazz playing, you know, like you said, there are people who have certain patterns and ideas that they run to all the time.
Yeah.
I'm not like that. You know, of course, we're human, so we do repeat ourselves and we do go, you know, move towards the same kind of areas. But
so you're always trying to take chances. You're always getting outside of the box when you're up there.
Yeah. And I'm always also trying to play compositionally. So it's that in itself, that paradigm. What sort of that? Breaks the notion of playing licks and ideas.
What does that mean when you're... I mean, obviously, we're talking... Who did I talk to? I talked to somebody else who said the same thing. I've talked to so many people all of a sudden, but... composing on stage. That's something else somebody said the other... You know Jose? I think he was up there with you. Was he?
No.
The opening night?
No, I don't think so.
Young jazz guy?
No.
Had the same sort of, he was talking about, I was like, well, what do you do when you improvise? He goes, I compose on stage. It's like, you know, I compose on stage.
Yeah.
So like the idea of being able to compose on stage would, presuppose that you're trying to avoid sequential repetition.
Yeah, and there's different layers of this too. I mean, everybody who improvises essentially is composing on stage, right? Yeah. But there, even more so, there's another level of actually... doing solo, playing solos that are compositional. That's a different thing than actually improvising and composing on stage. You know, that's a given already. Once you're improvising, you already are spontaneously composing, right? But what I'm talking about, if you look to someone like Jim Hall, the guitarist, he's, you know, my biggest jazz influence.
Jim Hall.
Yeah, Jim Hall on guitar for sure. Overall, I mean, there's so many, but... you know, if you see, if you hear how he tells a story, and I think that's essentially what I'm trying to say here, is when you compose a solo and it's a compositional, you know, approach, then you're essentially telling a longer story than if you're playing sort of licks and ideas, quick ideas that are repetitive, you know, you're repeating on every solo. Because you know, you're really trying to play the tune, right? The melody.
Yeah.
So if you're doing licks, then you're already negating the tune.
Yeah.
Because that, you know, you can play the same lick on this tune, and then suddenly you hear the guy play, or, you know, the person play it on a different tune.
Yeah.
And then so it's like, well, yeah, but you could have done the same exact solo, and maybe no one would even known it. You know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's you need to take advantage of the melodies and the actual composition of what you're playing on, and by doing that, in order to do that,
you have to keep yourself open.
In order to do that, you need to sort of negate this idea of playing licks,
right? I did see a player recently who you could just tell, like, he got nervous and he just went back to his licks. And
it was exactly like, that happened. Like, well, we all go through that once
in a while. We all do that.
Yeah.
We all get nervous. Yeah. It's super important for people.
You know, or if there's a time where, you know, the amp and your guitar is just not speaking.
Yeah.
You know how that happens?
I mean,
it's sort of like I'm playing, it's like, wow, what happened to my tone? Then suddenly, you know, you have this big wall in front of you that you know that you got to get over, and sometimes a preconceived idea line.
Yeah, well, there's like a meditative quality to what you're doing, whether you're any genre. You have to get in the zone, and it's hard to get in that zone in those situations, and then you don't want to take the shots. Because I feel like whenever we blow scales.
Yeah.
You know, because that's what happens to the classical. Whenever a scale is blown, which is kind of like the worst thing that happens, it usually is just you, literally like your body not allowing you to take that chance. Like just, and you call it your body, but it's really your brain.
Your body's
totally in charge. It's fine.
Yeah, of course.
In these situations, I mean, it takes an enormous amount of bravery to get in front of an audience and just start composing. But that's what you're doing. Do you ever feel limited? I mean, because that's the case against improvisation. Because we live in an improvisation-heavy musical culture. Musical culture, as far as instrumental music is concerned, is very. I feel like it's very heavily culturally in America. And pretty much all over the world, we gravitate towards improvisational music.
Yeah.
Do you feel ever like you don't get enough out of that? You don't get the time to really develop an idea like you would if you were composing off the guitar, or if you know, if you're composing note by note?
I mean, there's different layers to that question. I mean,
first question is, have you ever done that? Have you ever composed without improvising?
The strange thing is, like, I think they kind of go hand in hand. I think for every composer, they go hand in hand. I mean, you know, when you're composing,
you're improvising.
Yeah, I mean, yeah,
you are.
To a certain, absolutely. And then you're figuring out what sounds good. I mean, not everybody's a Mozart, right? I mean, I'll readily admit I'm not. You know, I don't hear my whole.
I'm also not Mozart.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, I don't hear everything ahead of time and place it on paper and say there it is. Now there are certain ideas I definitely hear, and then those, I may lay down and then make variations on. So I'm still using intuition and thought process all together, and technique and whatnot. But I think limited by if it's a live performance, I like to really, like this film score. I like to have enough composition in there that I've already pre-composed, and then take the risk with the extra 40%, something like that.
Yes,
like a 60-40 or 70-30 or sometimes 50-50. But I just want to make sure that I'm giving the audience and the musicians enough real stuff to hold on to, and stuff that I've vetted myself and really listened to over and over and thought, okay, yeah, this is really magical. This composition is magical.
Right.
You know, like as simple as a Stevie Wonder tune or something might be magical to some people, right?
Yeah.
And to me, it sure is, I mean, but people like Stevie and Bill Withers, you listen to these tunes and, they've just captured something that's undeniable. That's what I want my compositions to be like. And then on top of that, which they don't do particularly on that genre of music, is to improvise for 40% of that. So you sort of have this like balance of like something that's really strong and then really risky, and actually can be very strong but might not be that strong.
And that's
but it's really important.
The best comedians don't always worry about being funny if they worry about it at all.
Yeah. Then they also, if they start improvising, they'll improvise based on the solid material they've already, etched out previously.
Well, what's funny about this show is that, I'm a classical guitarist.
Yeah.
I am a classical, not really, but I've composed an album. I'm a composer.
Yeah.
I play composed music. I get on the show. Maybe I look at Wikipedia for 5 seconds and then I roll for an hour.
Yeah.
And I'm like, why do I not? Like, and I'm usually like, I'm just like, sometimes it gets me into trouble. Like, I'm sitting there and I'm like, shit, I got nothing to say to this person about this or that.
Music.
And then, but then other times it's like, it's great, but I'm willing to take that chance because I enjoy that headspace of just being able to like wait. Then it's a lot of it's waiting, isn't it? I mean, improvising is, I mean, it must be patience.
That's a great thing you just
What it requires here for me to
right.
I just have to wait, and then the more patient I am,
you're right. I mean,
and like if the guest is like you and he actually has he can talk, it's great. But if I'm in that position where I'm waiting and he cannot talk, and it happened.
Well, there's nothing wrong with space, but this is a program.
I got into trouble. I didn't get into big trouble, but I'm just saying, I'm willing to take that chance.
And then you take that on
patience.
You're a classical guitar player, so do you improvise much at all?
I mean, I like jam band improvise kind of. I'm 40, so I was around in the late 90s, mid 90s when people would kind of like get together at parties.
But you wouldn't do jam band with classical guitar. I mean, you're talking about. I'm saying, do you improvise like at home, just on classical guitar yourself?
No, like fiddle with it. Yeah.
Yeah, and come up with little ideas.
Yeah, I've got my little kind of like things that I do, and then like I'll look for something. Because that to me is why I started the whole thing in the first place.
Yeah, to create.
And that's the meditative quality of what we do.
Yeah, absolutely. And
I'm jealous of you guys. I'm really jealous. I've never been in front of an audience and just like. And improvised, but I
will try it at your next concert.
I will. Just be like, guys, guess what? This entire concert.
Forget
about it.
I don't know if I recommend the entire concert, but I talked to this guy Rez, and he recommended that.
I'm going to try playing the White Album backwards for the first time in my life.
Yeah, but you won't recognize it anyway, so it's okay.
Enjoy your meals.
Yeah, and don't forget to tip the waiter.
Don't forget to tip the waiter. You know, and we were talking about this jazz, the jazz life. The jazz life. I mean, do you teach? Do you have to teach? Do you teach?
Yeah, I have.
Are you from here?
No. I'm from New York.
Okay, you're from New York.
Yeah, I've been in New York for 25 years. Yeah. That's a long time. But I have a lot of private students, but I don't teach at a university any longer because the traveling, you know, it's like a little unfair to have students make up all their lessons at the end of the year, you know.
Okay, yeah.
I'll give you 3 lessons in a day, you know, none for 2 months or whatever. So it's a little, I don't know how people do it, you know, I guess.
Well, they just do it to the students.
I think that's it.
You're right. And we know who does it. And we're like, and you look at it and the students are always like, yeah, like I saw him or her. Yeah. Like I saw him, like, you know, like I saw him 3 times this semester.
You want your teacher to, you know, to be someone who's actually out there doing it.
You want that.
At the same time, though, I mean, like I mentioned, my first teacher, Paula Rose,
you were talking.
He was about, always there for us.
You know, when you brought him up, too, and I hope I'm not interrupting you too much, but I'm really interested in a lot of the things you say, and I forgot to bring that up, but you had talked about how he, he was a rarity in that he was a good teacher. It sounded like that's what you were saying.
Oh, yeah.
He's a good teacher. We don't have a lot of good teachers. We have a lot of great performers that we can learn from.
Yeah.
We can take from them.
Yeah.
But as guitarists and as musicians, we don't really work with a lot of great teachers.
Yeah, or it's hard to find them. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I've been to the master classes. Oh, absolutely.
No, I agree with you, man.
And it's like the best players are not really the best teachers.
Yeah,
there's like a Ben Verdery out there.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he's fun to watch.
Absolutely.
But is he the best guitar player in the world? I don't know. Maybe not. Probably not.
Yeah.
But he's an incredible teacher. You know what I mean?
Everybody has their thing. But I agree.
And Ben, you're one of my biggest influences. You know that? I love you.
Yeah.
And you're one of the best guitarists in the world. And I don't mean to say you're not a good guitarist. I'm just saying. You're an unbelievable teacher, and you touch any touches the lives.
No, I've seen Ben perform. He's quite amazing. Yeah,
he's quite amazing.
Yeah, I mean, people like Scott Tennant. I mean, he was a great teacher when I was there. I was still young and I studied with him for a year, but he was fantastic, and he's a great player.
Yeah.
So you know that's that. But
I'm talking about real talent as a teacher here. I'm not talking about Scott or Ben.
Yeah, well,
they're not. That's not what they do.
Yeah,
they're not teachers. They're not like verbal communicators.
I see what you mean. Yeah.
Ben is.
Yeah,
Ben is more.
Yeah,
Scott is less.
No. Yeah. I mean, but the thing is, it's equally important for this said teacher, to be a great player too. And Paul actually was a great player, also.
Yeah,
and that's and I also studied with John Abercrombie, who's recently just passed. Mm-hmm. You know, unfortunately, a little bit after that, when I was 23 or something, and he was also a great teacher and you know, a great performer. So you do find these people, you know, once in a while. But to your point, you know, I mean, we've all had like amazing players who just sit there and you know, hey, play this, play you know, it's
play
like,
this.
They
play
just
that.
They have no larger program or
concept.
Yeah,
I mean, what you want is you want the balance, like which is what Scott and I mean, those guys are different kind of size. I think they're both kind of different sizes at the same point.
Absolutely,
but definitely you're looking for that kind of a balance in a
teacher. Yeah,
and it's rare. I think the teacher aspect is rare. Like Aaron Shear was a teacher. He was not a guitarist.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and on that note, I will plug my. I have a book.
Okay,
that,
let's talk about. That, let's talk about your book for a little bit.
Yeah,
that
it's not out yet, but it's Hal Leonard. It's going to be. It's called
Hal Leonard. Congratulations.
It's called New Dimensions in Jazz Guitar, and that is something that I'm very proud of. Maybe by the end of the year, it'll be out. They're formatting it,
right?
But it's got a lot of interesting concepts that. Crossover from Indian music that I've learned, you know, playing with a lot of Indian classical musicians and studying to what the degree I've studied that, but as applicable to jazz and you know, so it's not talking about Indian music per se, but it's talking about what I learned, and so that's something that's going to be interesting to get a feedback from various people, because it's really approaching it from somewhat of a holistic jazz sensibility rather than, you know, you mentioned licks and bebop and yeah. things like that. It's not stylistic. This book is not going to be stylized.
Yeah.
It's coming from all the things I've learned from, you know, from various musics, playing classical guitar, playing, you know, Indian rhythms.
Well, the Indian stuff, I mean, what was that trip like? Because did you go back often as a kid, or did you?
No, a few times I've been back, mm-hmm. But I definitely,
there's one guy with a motorcycle. He comes by every day. Okay. It's like one guy with a motorcycle here.
The Indian thing, I mean, that's I am from Pakistan originally, and, Pakistan and India are really essentially one place.
I keep saying Indian. I don't know why.
Oh, no, that's okay. I see myself as Indian. Honestly, when you're outside of the continent, subcontinent, it becomes obvious that you're more of one type of person than
all the separate. Was your mom from India? Your dad?
My mom was from Pakistan. My dad was from India. So in the partition, they ended up both in Pakistan. And that's where I was born. So
yeah,
that happened. And I have that in my background. It's a music. South Asian music is a music of such diversity, and there's so much fruit to be had there, you know. And also within South Asian music, there's Qawwali music, which is an entirely different thing. There's Hindustani music, which is different than Carnatic music, which is from the south. You know, so you have all these different, sub-genres of music. And so I've studied those and played those a lot, but I grew up playing mostly jazz, and so I had this kind of it's a paradigm that is somewhat unique to my upbringing. And
yeah,
I mean, to share that with everything I do.
I think Indian music, and not Indian music, just what would you call that? Asian South. Not South.
Yeah, South Asian.
South Asian.
Yeah.
Fertile Crescent. Where's the Fertile Crescent? Is that? No, that's the other end. That's over.
Yeah.
That's like the Middle East.
Yeah.
So we're talking about India, Pakistan.
Bangladesh. Well, Bangladesh is now.
Right.
Sri Lanka.
Right. So those places. Yeah. And in those places, when you talk about the, is there any sort of, you know what I'm really curious about? Because it seems to be a lot of different instrumentation. A lot of different approaches to melody. Did you know, in your studies of that music over there, and I really haven't talked to people who know a lot about that music. I haven't talked to somebody that really does it. I guess you might be the first guest that I've had on that went out there and really, learned about it. And I think that's something, seems like something a jazz musician would do.
Yeah, exactly.
but like doing it, or a Beatle. But going out there, I mean, did you find anything that was harmonically? Because they don't seem to do so many harmonic shifts there.
No, and they still don't. It's not
harmonically moving.
Other than Bollywood, which is a different, thing, completely,
Right.
They borrow from everywhere. But no, the Indian classical music is not harmonically based.
No.
It's modally based for sure. You're not going to get, progressions that they solo over.
That's okay.
It's a different kind of thing, you can see when Coltrane sort of went into his modal thing.
Yeah.
He also was studying Indian music, and it's kind of stuck.
Okay. Oh, wow.
It's kind of stuck there, in terms of the modality concept. I mean, ragas are very, very complex compared to your regular old scale.
Yeah.
Ragas have very distinct personalities within each rag,
Yeah.
But they're still not harmonic in nature.
No.
But that's where someone like...
It's a drone and a...
Yeah. But that's where someone like myself comes and from a bit of a Western perspective and takes those notes and creates harmonic shifts within those notes, and maybe puts two ragas together. So now you have really a larger,
there you go.
You know, and then that's how I compose. You know,
that's beautiful.
Partly how I compose.
That's partly what you're doing right now with your compositions.
That's just one device. You know,
what's the other one? Ragas and tals, or
yeah, well, tal is the rhythm cycle aspect.
Oh, okay,
yeah.
Right.
I mean, of course, I love writing and.
But so there's, you know, rhythm cycles, and then there's the ragas, which are the
melodic content. Cycles, yeah, and there's no harmonic terminology.
No.
See, there you go. Yeah.
Right. There you go.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I had a wonderful time talking to you.
Yeah, no, thank you.
I hope you don't mind. We went, you know, a little over, but I feel like we have a lot to talk about.
No, that's good. I appreciate it. Yeah.
Well, see you in New York. We gotta get together.
Yeah, I'll give you my card. And,
absolutely.
Absolutely.
You saw I have a card here.
Yeah, exactly.
This is my little card pile. One card. Did you see that guy?
No, I haven't.
Jontavious Willis?
No, not yet.
18-year-old blues guy?
Oh, no, not yet.
Jesus, dude, this guy's unreal. He played that night, you played the first night.
Oh, yeah, no, I didn't. I haven't been able to see a lot. I've been actually busy, you know.
I've been busy doing this, so I pop up when I can.
But. Yeah.
Well, man, it was good meeting you. I hope to see you again.
Absolutely, bro.
Yeah. All right, thanks.
All right, that does it for my time with Rez. I hope you guys enjoyed that. Make sure you go over to... I haven't set up the Rosetta Stone thing, and I forgot to talk about it anyway, but make sure you go over to Brett Williams Music and become a member. We got a couple of new members this week. I'm going to go out. Eventually I'm going to look all you guys up and say thanks individually, but I really appreciate it, and I'll see you guys soon. Thanks so much. Enjoy your spring. It's the first warm day we've had here in New York. All right? Do your best. I'll see you soon.